Hello and welcome to Books of the Year, which is a podcast from your friends at Books of the Year, Evolving Books.
It is, as we always say, pretty obvious because you've already downloaded it, but thanks for coming anyway.
Yes, that's right. Everyone's saying it's the number one books podcast in the world, and
everyone's saying
they're probably
that.
Right.
Yeah.
Claire says, this is Claire Hanscom. Dear both, quick note to say thank you for your recent Michael Connelly episodes. He is one of my favourite authors of all time, and I loved your chat with him. I haven't got to his new novel yet, but I'm off on holiday in a couple of weeks' time, and his book will be the first one I read by the pool. By the way, I love one of the questions that comes around on your Q&A episodes about how your guests order their bookshelves. I am quirky in that respect. That's how a friend described it anyway. As I order my shelves in date order.
Wow.
I think the first one on the shelves is War and Peace. And the most recent, well, it'll be the new Michael Connelly, of course. Is that strange? Right. So it's the date of publication.
Yes.
Not
yes,
the date
yes.
you got them.
No. But I like that.
That is quite... I don't think we've ever come across
that. No, we haven't. And it would suggest, wouldn't it? Although I suppose you often... I've bought a book this morning that I know is going to be... is an older book. So that would go sort of in the middle, wouldn't it?
What year is it from?
So I don't know when it's from, but it's Stalingrad by your man. Anthony Beaver. That's him. Yes. So from years ago, so that would
1990 something.
Something
like
1990, yes, indeed. An email from Jaime, is this? I'm going to say Jaime. Dear Simon and Matt, I listen to Brian.
It could be Jamie.
Could be Jamie, but misspelt Jamie. So let's say either. I listened to Bryony Gordon on your podcast recently. I must admit I'd never heard of her or her books before listening to your chat, but as a 40-something-year-old woman who is giving less of a fudge about things, I like the sound of her book, People Pleaser. I've just finished it and I thoroughly enjoyed it. A really fun, funny, and in some places, angry read. It's just what I needed but didn't know it. It's a shame this is her only novel. I hope she writes more. I'm now going to pick up one of her other non-fiction books, Mad Woman, which also looks right up my street. Appreciate the recommendations as always. Let's say Jamie Futter.
I think that's right. I think that's what it is.
But we spelled Jamie. I'm going to just pick this up, Jamie. J-A-M-I-E, don't we? That's how we spell it.
No, not always.
Do we not?
No, there's a Jamie that spells it like this, who we work with at Greatest Hits.
Is there?
Yes, that's right.
I'm trying to think of said Jamie.
I'll point it out to you.
Okay.
You can email us at any time, of course. And if your name needs phonetic spelling, then
yes,
please help
great.
Us out. Books of the Year at yahoo.com. We're on Instagram, Threads and Blue Sky, at Books of the Year. Time now to speak to actor, comedian and best-selling author. That'll be Dawn French. Well, this just isn't any podcast about books. This is a Dawn French podcast about books. God, I thought I had to get that in, Dawn.
Stop it now.
How are you?
I'm really good, actually, yeah. I'm feeling quite dandy at the moment.
Is that because you've made a foray into London?
It is partly that. I do get overexcited about coming up to London these days. It is. And I get a bit overwhelmed, I have to say. As I entered here, as you know, I've got excited about the slightly posh coffee that I've got in front of me. But I get excited about seeing friends when I come up to London. And I get overwhelmed by the amount of things that are on offer. Listen, I lived in London for a long time.
Yeah.
But when I come now, I feel like, oh, all these plays. And I've got to do that and do that and do that. And then I get exhausted by just how little time I have to do it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And I also, I don't know if you find this about London, I think, oh, that needs a tidy up over there. That's a bit dirty. Oh, that person looks a bit sad. Oh, gosh, is she all right over there? I'm very distracted by the busyness, by the sort of cacophony of it all.
Yes.
Not just the, you know, not just the sound, but the feel or look of London. Having said that, I'm delighted to be here with you.
Even though you might be concerned about people wandering past.
I'm looking at them now because I can see some people wandering past that might need a bit of help.
Are you easily distracted?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you say that because I am. But because I am, I think that certainly when it comes to writing, I make sure that I do office hours and I close myself off.
Mm-hmm.
And do you know what I can't do while I'm writing? Is read somebody else's book. So writing time which might be anything, might name sort of 6 months to 10 months or something for me anyway, means I can't read other books during that time. Which
no
is,
books at all? Fiction,
can't.
No.
Do you know
what?
I'm scared. It's partly a distraction. Also scared that I might steal or something, that porous brain might just suck up something like a sponge, or, you know, and I don't want to do that. Mm. And I made a mistake, a huge mistake, whilst writing this particular book that we're going to go on to talk about, which was that somebody, you know, as I'm sure happens with you guys, 100% sure it happens to you guys, I get sent quite a lot of books to read, to give a quote or whatever. Mm. And I've got a big pile of those, but and I'm ignoring them. But one book I was sent for that specific purpose was Kay Tempest's latest novel. And I've got such a crush, a sort of brain crush on Kay Tempest that I couldn't resist it. So I did, and it was a proof copy. And I read that book and knocked my confidence for six because it's so good.
Yeah.
Okay. So, oh, that's interesting. So you weren't inspired to do better. You found it intimidating.
Yeah. Okay. Because I thought, what is the point of writing any words anymore? Because
that's
he
how you
has
do
managed
it
to do it better than all okay of us.
However, well, let's find out what people think, because your new book is called Enough. Matt, describe this.
Yes, we're all agreed. It's a very classy cover, isn't it? So it's so background of mainly white with the bottom band of orange, Dawn French in red at the top, Enough in big bold black capitals across the middle, but the letters of Enough are gradually getting thinner. But your eye is going to be drawn mainly to, well, we're just seeing a sort of some legs kicking off a green sofa with a bird just perched on one of the slippers that's being kicked off there. Mm. And then below it, Etta's found the cure for old age, but her family won't like it.
And that bird you're referring to, yes, there is a white crow.
Okay.
I didn't know there was such a thing.
No.
Well, the theory is that if there is a white crow, that disproves the theory that all crows are black.
Right.
Okay. And that's it. This is, I have written about this in the book. And really, for me, that's about doubt. So if there's a little crack of doubt, of uncertainty, you might be able to destroy somebody's resolve. And Etta sees a white crow. And there are such things, albino crows, there are.
Would you not think it's a seagull?
No, Simon. It's,
well, do you know,
crow.
I was going to say, and
otherwise,
then I thought, this doesn't look like a seagull.
Work.
No. No, it doesn't look like a seagull, though, does it?
It's
no,
not stealing your pie.
And may I tell you, when I was first sent the graphic, it did look a bit like a seagull. And I had to say,
enough of that kind of thing.
Guys, we need an absolute crow so that Simon Mayo doesn't think that's a seagull.
All right. Yeah. He needs a little line saying, not a seagull.
Not a seagull.
Okay, so I'm imagining that they're the legs of Etta, who's our main character, who's
correct
referred to on the front page. Etta's found a cure for old age.
Yeah.
Family won't like it. Introduces to Etta and the family, as we are introduced to them in your book in a raucous, riotous kind of opening.
Okay. So Etta is 68, a bit like me. And that's pretty much where it ends, the similarity. And she decides to gather her family together at the beginning of a day. They're all staying together in her home. And she takes them down to the beach. And this is at sunrise. And she explains to them that by sunset, she won't be there anymore because Etta has made a decision about her life. And she has decided to excuse her kids from the difficulties, as she imagines they will be, of older life, of the sort of winter of life, if you like. And so she is going to take her life by the end of the day. And so this really, this book, is a sort of live suicide note. It takes place in 24 hours. And instead of going ahead with this plan and them finding a note, she decides that it would be a kindness to give them all a chance to investigate it and to ask her any questions, and she will answer anything in this 24 hours. But she is resolved to do this, and she thinks she's doing something selfless. And then the rest of the book is the argument of her family as to why she should not go ahead with this plan. And she has a son called Vernon, and he has a wife called Lizzie. So that's her daughter-in-law. She has a daughter called Dolly, and she has a grandchild called Pearl. And these are the folk. These are our cast, really. And these are the folk that are on the beach that have this devastating news.
You've written about the impact of your father's suicide before. Is that presumably where this book started? I just wonder how long this has been gestating, you know, this has been rumbling in your mind, because this is a unique premise, this kind of explosion in the first 50 pages, which then dominates everything throughout the rest of the book.
Yeah.
I imagine you've been thinking about this for a while.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny, isn't it? I mean, this happened to me. My dad sadly took his own life when I was 19. And obviously, you know, when you're 19 and a bomb goes off like that in your family, you know, I was dripping with grief about it. I was furious. I was sad. I was everything. And as life has gone on, I've sort of crept towards an understanding about it. The more I've talked about it, the more I've talked to other people, the more I understand about mental ill health, the more, you know, the more I see that back then, all those years ago, my dad didn't have access to talking therapy of any sort. In fact, what he had was electroconvulsive therapy, which probably wasn't much help. Plus, you know, he was an ex-serviceman. So the shame of talking about it, the seeming weakness of it, you know, all of this crap that goes with it. I have kind of lived a life where I just want to kind of reclaim his right, if you like. I'm not advocating that this is the right route for anybody. And I need to make it really clear that Etta is very different to my dad. And Etta is well. She's mentally well and she's physically well. This is a decision for completely different reasons. Someone like my dad lived with, you know, the black dogs. He lived with depression. Not that I knew about it as a kid, honestly, did not know. So this was a huge shock when it finally happened, because my brother and I, you know, we had a very happy, engaged dad. That's who we had, a jolly fellow, kind and interested in us, but who had to occasionally go to bed with something called migraines. I mean, ironically, he did have migraines as well, but I know now that my mum, you know, he would just have to take to his bed and be quiet for a couple of days. And now I understand that, but I didn't then. But it was over after a couple of days and he'd be back. So, you know, it was fine. So I suppose, yes, I haven't been thinking all this time, oh, I must write a book about this. But what I have been thinking is I want to write books about big, difficult things and see if I can bring something life-affirming to it, or something joyful, or even something funny on occasion. Is it possible to write about big issues and be funny about it? Yes, we know that. We know that from the history of many, many books. So let me challenge myself to see if that's what I can do. I mean, the last book I wrote was about identity, and I do have an adopted kid. So I guess I do sometimes write about things I've got a little bit of knowledge about, maybe, or a bit of agency with. But I didn't set out to compare anything about my dad's decision in this book. However, I've sort of got my dad in my back pocket all the time when I was writing it.
So I came to your book, Dawn. I had no idea about your dad. And so I started reading the book completely fresh. And it struck me that sort of midway through the book, there is and it felt to me like a key exchange in the book is Etta is making Cornish pasties with her daughter Dolly, and so she's given the whole family, as you say, this news on the beach, and it's, as you say, an explosion of reactions. And Etta and Dolly are in the kitchen and she's making Cornish pasties and they're talking about this news, and Dolly is obviously struggling to get her head around it. And at one point, Etta says, I'm in charge in life, in my life that is, and I like that. All I'm asking is to be in charge in death. We're all heading there, dolls. I'm just moving the finish line a little closer and making it easier for you in the long run. Knowing what I know now, it struck me that I appreciate Etta is not your dad,
yeah.
But it struck me still that there's got to be a bit of you in there trying to find reason to what is obviously a really devastating part of your life.
Definitely. And, you know, one of the things that I've had to understand about my dad is you have to be in a place, probably seven kinds of hell, to make that decision for him. But he would have he must have been thinking, because I know my dad and how selfless my dad was. He must have been thinking, this will be better for them. Mm. The fact is, it isn't. But he must have been in that mindset to do that. So there is something, what you say is true. There is something in Etta that has gone to that extreme place where she thinks, do kids, and she's also lost her parents, and she has nursed parents, and so she knows what it's like to deal with the decrepitude of that last bit. And who knows when the last bit is? None of us know. But Etta's deciding to just remove all of that. There is an extreme to Etta, which is about control and being neat and tidying everything up. So she's really jumped the gun there and has decided, right, we must control everything and get everything sorted. I get the house sorted, get the money sorted, get everything so they won't have to look after me. Just do this and then it's fine. Is that selfless or is that selfish? I don't know.
That's what everyone will wrestle with as to what they think, whether it's selfish or whether it's selfless. I did think through the first half of the book, maybe you can explain a bit. Why would I understand the cleanliness of the decision? Yeah. I understand the clean lines. I can see the appeal of that. I'm 1 year younger than you, but when you get to this stage, you inevitably are thinking about the next 20 years. But why would she, in good health, with a nice house and a supportive, mad family, why would she inflict so much pain on all of them? What would she say?
It's maddening, isn't it? And I think you can be angry with Etta. I was angry with her when I was writing it. But you know, what I wanted to write about was somebody who, A, thinks this is the right thing to do, maybe a bit too soon, but she's the right thing to do. And B, she's made her mind up. So she's sitting in a rather righteous place where if you have considered something in great detail and you have come to a conclusion like this, which she has, and it has taken time to do and has not been easy for her. When this book starts, the decision is made. So she's maddeningly casual about it. But that's because when you make your mind up about something and you believe you are right, that's the mountain you sit on. You sit in that lofty place. And then you impart to others. And she knows it will be painful, but she thinks the alternative would be more painful. Mm. I personally think she's wrong. This is not my plan. You know, this is Etta's plan. And a person like that who thinks like that. But I, you know, at this age, when I talk to other people at this age, we are talking about the future. We are talking about our kids and how they will cope with stuff. We're talking about how are they provided for? Can they cope? Are they grown up enough? Are they independent enough? How would they manage without me? I'm the fulcrum for everything. I'm the enabler. I'm the provider. How will they manage? How will they manage? And I think Etta has made a sort of peace with herself about this decision. And really part of what I wanted to write, and that's why it had to be such a serious plan, is how do you climb down off that great big ledge when you've made that decision? And in a funny way, the White Crow has something to do with it, and Vernon especially. Well, everybody influences her decision, but Vernon especially finds a crack and he manages to creep into it and to give her something else to think about. And I have to say to you that when I started writing this book, I thought I knew what the ending was. And then I changed my mind. And then I changed it back. And then I decided to surrender and see if I could write the arguments that would persuade me, Dawn, the writer, and Etta, the much more resolved person than me, Dawn, to change her mind.
Is that improv?
I did. Yes, I guess so.
Wow.
I mean, you know, part of writing for me is, you know, it's like being in a room with Jen or, you know, doing a character acting, whatever you want to call it. Improv, definitely. Of just, I really enjoy being Dolly. I really enjoy being Vernon and I really enjoy being Pearl and Lizzie, actually. But I, you know, I want to, I have to creep into those characters. I'm sure most writers have to do that. I don't know how they do it, but I do it by literally trying to invent a voice for them and invent a language and, you know who they are and what they would say. So funnily enough, when you're talking about that piece where they're making the pasties together. I mean, of course, look, I'm from Cornwall. Pasties mean everything. Mm. I've lost my mum, you know, years ago. My mum's, I will never taste a pasty like my mum's pasty. Yeah. And, you know, I had a mother-in-law, she made some quite good, where they were nowhere near as good as my mum's pasties, even if they're made the same way. The love that is folded into them when it's your parent, you know, there's nothing like that. And that whole scene really is about imparting some knowledge, but it's also about saying difficult things. It's a bit like when you're driving the car. I certainly know with my own daughter, if we're in the car looking ahead, she tells me some quite shocking, alarming things or difficult stuff is talked about because you've got a purpose, you're driving, you're looking ahead, and you've got, you know, you're doing something else to distract you from the difficult stuff so you can have those conversations. Plus, Dolly has found out, hasn't she, that she may never taste this pasty ever again. Mm. She doesn't know how to make it. So that, you know, there's practical reasons to do it, and there's the sort of visceral moment when they have to talk.
So obviously the central theme of this book is going to be a difficult part, but I don't want people to think, people listening to this podcast, think this is a dark book and there's no light at all, because I'm going to tell you about a bit where my heart leapt when I was reading this. And that is when we have a sort of flashback, or we have a number of flashbacks through Etta's life, and she goes on a trip to Barcelona. Now, Barcelona is a city I love. If I could live anywhere else but London, I would live in Barcelona. And I remember about 20 years ago, I was out there covering David Beckham, of all things, and I had a free afternoon, and I literally turned a corner and found myself in front of Gaudí's apartment. And so Etta visits Gaudí's apartment, and almost a mirror image of what happened to me. In other words, she doesn't want to go. She's not really that. And then walks through and her jaw is on the floor, as mine was. So I just want you to, the reasons for including that visit, but also that injection of light into this book. That's what struck
good.
Me.
Good. Well, thank you for noticing that. I mean, I was aware that if you write a book that takes place in 24 hours and that is pretty intense, you know, I decided I needed, it's a sort of sweep through a very messy life, but I needed shards of brightness in there, and I needed you to know Etta, and the only way I can inform you about her is to give you a little slice of each decade of her life. And I want you to know that she has been happy, that she has been loved, that she has known how to love, that she's cared for people, they've cared for her, and she's had moments like that. She's had, you know, epiphanies. She's had erotica. She's been sensual moments where she's connected with people and with places. So this is not a wretched, traumatized life. This is a full life that she's had. And she's vital. You know, that's the thing. That's why it's unusual, as you say. And possibly hard to believe that she would ever make this decision. But that was my challenge, to try and make that as real as I could.
One of the things I took away from the kind of diary pieces that we get where we learn more about Etta. I wrote down Donny Osmond versus David Cassidy. That's what I wrote down.
Hey! Oh, yeah.
Because depending on when you were at school, this is a very live debate. And I'm married to someone who is in the Donny Osmond fan club.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Etta is very much on the David Cassidy side of things.
Yeah, absolutely. As was I, I'm afraid. And was it when you were at school, or wasn't it the type of person you were in school? Wasn't it some pretty similar?
I'm going to think those were around about the same time.
About
surely,
the same time.
I mean, yeah. I was sort of, it was, you know, Slade, T-Rex, that kind of thing,
yeah,
on the boys' side.
But yeah.
We didn't like Donny Osmond or David Cassidy.
Donny was just too wholesome for me, but hey, maybe that's a good sign about your partner.
Donny is touring again this year.
Let's not.
There's a bit
no,
further
let's
on.
Let's remember things as they were. And can I just tell you, sorry yes, to interrupt you. A while back, because I had a massive crush on David Cassidy.
He was a very good-looking guy.
I think that might have been the first poster that I had on my wall. And I remember it was him, and his shirt was open a bit, and there was that little bit of his sort of groin, the little top
filth.
It was filth. And it was the first time I slightly woke up to a boy, if you know what I mean. That was it. So, and also the hair and all the rest of it. And he looked like a bit slightly naughty and whatever. So I was very, very attracted to David Cassidy. And then, you know, Could It Be Forever? All the songs that were only written for me, you know, all of that. It was very engaging. And then the Screaming Girls. But many, many years later, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago, he came to London. He was performing, I think, at the Apollo. I got a phone call. My agent got a phone call because I had written in my autobiography about my love for David. And got a phone call inviting me to go on stage and sit there while he sang, I think it was Cherish or whatever, to me. Can you imagine that as a teenager, having had that? But, and, you know, I could not do it. I could not do it because I know that all those teenage fantasies would be gone in a moment, because now you're on stage with a sort of lizard. And it was a bit unpleasant, and I knew that that wasn't it. And anyway, you know, the more I grew past Donnie, the more I thought, past David, sorry, you thought maybe Donnie was a better option.
I played Dean Friedman on the radio just a couple of days ago, and I thought of you because you love him more than you love David Cassidy.
I certainly do, and he's still touring now.
He is.
I love Dean Friedman. Those story songs are the best, aren't they?
So if you got the message, sorry, we're off topic here, but if you got a message saying Dean wants to have you on stage while he sings Shopping Bag Ladies,
well,
would you
Shopping
say
Bag
yes?
Ladies, or I have been to Dean Friedman concerts, and I have to keep it a bit quiet because Dean knows that I'm a fan, and afterwards he has often said to me, please come back, such as, and we'll do what's the call and response song?
Oh yes,
Lucky Stars.
Lucky, you can thank you. Which the woman doesn't get a credit.
Your lucky stars.
Not as bright as you like to think you are.
You are. That's right. But it goes between a boy and a girl, and he has said you come back and you could sing that bit, and you think, yeah, but that's, I'll do it badly. That's the point. When I've done it in my bedroom with the hairbrush, I'm magnificent.
Yes, you are great.
I don't want to really do it.
Anyway, that was a slight musical diversion. Intriguingly, the different so not on the flashbacks, but in the 24 hours, we have the first chapter is matins at 5 a.m.
Yes.
Then it goes to Lords at 6. Then it goes to Prime at 7. So this is a clerical, it's like a monk's life.
Canonical hours.
Canonical hours is obviously the phrase that I was reaching for. Why is that?
Well, originally I thought I just need to, and again, this is my need for the neatness, which is a little bit in Etta. I need to order it correctly, and I need to have the timings. I want the reader to know exactly where we are in the day. So I literally wanted to split it into that. And I thought, well, you know, okay, I can put 9 a.m. or I can put 2 p.m. or that's a bit boring. How else is time divided up? And that's really where I went to with that. And I thought originally, like a lot of things in writing, like your title, like many things, it's your working thing and you don't know if it, and then you fall in love with it and it becomes completely You know, if you're 10 months sitting at your desk, eventually you love this idea of these kind of hours. And I thought, yeah, OK, they can go there. But I have been asked whether it's a religious connection. And it isn't. It isn't.
It's just a useful way of dividing.
Absolutely that.
It struck me a number of times that I could see this as a play. Because of the structure, because of the 24 hours, because the cast are here, we spend time in Etta's head, but we spend time in the rest of the family's head as well. We have their points of view. It felt like it. I could see it on stage.
Oh, that's interesting. But how would you go to Barcelona?
I changed the lighting.
Yes, I'd have a big picture of the cathedral.
Yes,
and how?
And a Spanish flag, some Spanish music, maybe
and some tapas. Thank you for your offer of the play, but I'm going to trump you with a film.
I feel as though it could be a film.
It could be a film. And isn't it interesting that Etta is my age, Simon?
Yes, wow. That's right. Sorry, a little bit slow there.
I've got a little...
You could do a play as well.
You could, but...
So as Matt says, there's some riotous comedy in here. I love the family swear spectacularly at each other.
Yes.
The put-downs are incredible. And I liked Lizzie, the daughter-in-law, the quiet one.
Yeah.
Who often sits at the table, you know, thinking, how did I get involved with this? So I love the construction of the family that you put around the table. The power of this book, as I think everyone is realizing as they listen to you talk about it, is that you go away and you talk about it.
Yeah.
Is she selfish? Is she selfless? Is that the kind of thing that you would do? Because you do get, this is happening everywhere, you get to a certain stage in life, maybe earlier, where you say, okay, well, what do I want the last 20, 30 years of my life to be like? And even though this isn't about assisted dying, that is obviously a big debate which has been happening
absolutely
a lot in this country and happens in many countries. It sort of plays into that, doesn't it? This book feels as though it's part of that conversation.
Yeah.
What right do you have to
over
finish
your
things?
Own life?
Yes.
Agree.
And what role should the state have in saying,
absolutely,
I don't think you should do that?
Yeah.
And have you changed your views?
No. I mean, you know, I'm at that age now where I've been around death with my parents. I've been around it with my in-laws. I've been around it with grandparents. And my mother's death, my mum died when she was 77, about 13 years ago now, you know, was a very beautiful thing, if it can be such. She was very afraid. My mum had lung cancer and it all developed very quickly. And my mum was a great kind of spiritual believer. And I remember when she got the diagnosis from the oncologist and we were driving back and I was a bit in shock. And they were suggesting she would start some chemo and whatever. And she said, well, look, it's fine. It's win-win. What on earth? How can you say it's win-win about this? And she said, well, I either stay here with you guys or I go and see your dad. Mm. That was my mum's belief. Mm. Absolutely, 100%. So when my mum was dying, she said to us, I'm not scared of dying at all. She said, I'm scared of not being able to breathe, which was gradually what was happening. So there was the most amazing moment in the hospital, in our local hospital in Plymouth called Derriford in Plymouth. And my mum's in this room and my brother and I are there. We're all aware what's going on. My mum's a bit frightened, but she's accepting what's going on. And this wonderful woman walked into the room with a couple of students with her because it's a teaching hospital. And she said, hello, Roma. I'm Mary. I think she was called Mary. I'm the head of the palliative care team. I know who you are because I know what you've done for this city, because my mum was pretty important in Plymouth and she changed a lot of things. She headed up a charity. She helped a lot of people with drug and alcohol problems and stuff like that. And she was, you know, a significant person. Anyway, she said, I know what you've done for this city and I respect you. Now, let me do my job. I'm very good at my job. What would you like to happen, Roma? And my mum said, you know, I just want to, I'm so tired now. I want to go to sleep and I don't want to wake up. Then so be it. This is what we will do. And she explained at that point, the Liverpool care pathway, which I think has slightly changed since. But anyway, she explained to my mum how this would work. My mum had time to gather us all together. We all said our goodbyes. We had a few laughs. I can't believe we did, but we did. Because that's what our family did. And I'm pretty sure lots of families do this in the most traumatic moments. And that's what I hope I've done with this book, is in difficult moments, real family humour is what gets you through everything. It's the process of it. It's how we connect. But anyways, you know, my mum had agency over what happened in that moment. And so we were able to say goodbye to her, and they started the kind of drivers and whatever. And it was maybe a day later, she was gone. But it was all headed by her, controlled by her, but with respect from this wonderful woman.
So many people don't have that.
They don't have it. And so when it comes to the assisted dying bill, I cannot understand how we can't be merciful. But I also see that I don't know enough about it then. Why are we not all thinking the same thing? Why? And I know that it's nuanced. I know it's complicated. And I know that, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I don't know all the caveats. It would have to be lawyers and family and doctors and the agency of that actual person. Everybody would have to agree, and it would have to be, you know, very watertight. I understand that. I tell you, I was listening the other day to Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart.
And the rest is politics.
Yes,
I
was listening to that, and they were talking about this subject, and I was thinking, come on, because Alistair was spouting similar things, and I thought, why has this not got through Parliament? How has it been? It was stopped in the Lords, wasn't it, the last time? And then Rory said something very interesting. He said his fear about it is that if it does go through, like so many kind of social constructs like this, big laws like this, poor people will be the people that suffer. They'll be left out. They will feel like they're a burden. They will feel like they have to go. There won't be anybody to speak on their behalf. Mm-hmm. I had never considered that. Mm. I know there's the religious stuff. There's the, you know, I know the moral stuff. I know all of that. I had never considered the kind of, you know, the social injustice that it might bring. And I had to have a second thought about that. So I need to investigate it a bit further.
But anyway, but the power of enough is that you'll be entertained and you'll laugh and you'll, as we said, a lot of cursing. There's a lot of fun, a lot of food. There are recipes at the end.
There are.
Tomato sauce recipes and all, you know, and all that kind of stuff. It's a classic Dawn French book. But when you finish it, you will want to talk about it with other people.
I hope so. I really hope so.
I think this book has a long tail.
Oh, thank you. I really pray that you're right.
And when the play arrives,
I'll be there on the first night,
and I'll say see.
Told you.
Dawn, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Book is enough, and there'll be further conversation with Dawn just in a few days' time when she does the Q&A. But for the moment, Dawn, thank you.
Thank you.